but it held so far good that the favorite was being sent a journey on account of fraternal discord, and Jacob conformed to the pattern by fixing the time of Joseph's departure for the earliest dawn, before sunrise, it having been so in his own case. But when the parting took place, Jacob, or rather Rebekah, for he was playing the mother's role, held the traveller in long embrace, murmuring blessings against his cheek, took an amulet from his own neck and hung it round the boy's, pressed him to his heart again and again, and all in all behaved as though Joseph were to be gone for years or for ever, 17 days or more distant Nehiraean words, into the unknown, whereas instead, amply supplied with provisions, he was setting out, to his own great joy, on safe roads, and to travel no farther than to Shechem, which shows that a man can behave out of all proportion, as measured by his own knowledge, while from the point of view of the still unknown destiny, his conduct may turn out to have been only too suitable. There may even lie some consolation therein, when we learn the real state of the case. Thus men should never take leave of each other lightly, for then, should the worst happen, they can say to themselves, "At least I did press him to my heart." Father and son took leave in the dawning, standing at the stirrup of white Huldah, who was laden down with good things and adorned with glass beads and bright worsted flowers. The leave-taking, of course, was only the last of the many counsels, admonitions, warnings which had gone before. Jacob had instructed the boy in his route and the well-known stages on it, just in his mother's way, had warned him of the dangers of overheating and sudden cold, given him the names of folk and brethren in the faith in the various villages at which the traveller might spend the night, and sternly forbade him, when he touched at the city of Jerusalem, and saw at Baal's temple the dwellings of those consecrate to Asherah, who lived and moved and had their being in her, to permit himself the smallest speech with them. Above all, he enjoined him to behave with particular courtesy toward the brethren. It could do no harm, he remarked, were Joseph to fling himself down 7 times before them, addressing them frequently as lords, when they would in all likelihood resolve to dip their hand at once in the bowl with him, and not to go from his side for the rest of their lives. Much of all this, Rebekah, Jacob, repeated afresh in the gray morning, before he allowed the youth to fling his leg over his ass, chirrup to it, and ride off northwards. Jacob even went a piece alongside the lively Huldah, as she curvetted in the high spirits of the dawn. But he could not keep it up long, and stopped with an absurdly heavy heart. One last gleam of Joseph's teeth as the lad looked laughing back and waved his hand. Then his son's figure was hidden by a turn in the road. Joseph had ridden away. He saw him no more. Joseph journeys toward Shechem. The boy, no longer under the father's eye, but pleasantly absorbed in his own well-being, sitting far back on the crupper of his beast, with his slim brown legs stretched out and his body leaning gallantly backwards, trotted in the tender light of the morning sun through hilly country on the road to Bethlehem. He felt entirely in harmony with the whole situation as he saw it, viewed with amused and indulgent forbearance the long-drawn-out character of Jacob's farewell, and felt not a whit weighed down by the consciousness that at this first separation he had snapped his fingers at the parental concern. Jacob certainly had expended himself in instruction and advice, forgetting neither precept nor warning. One thing only had he neglected. By reason of a singular and not quite innocent lapse of memory, he had refrained from cautioning the boy on a certain matter, upon a certain subject or object. Nor did it again occur to his mind's eye until so horribly made present to his material sight. It was the Ketonet. He had not told Joseph to leave it at home, and Joseph had slyly and silently taken advantage of the lapse. He had it with him. He was so on fire to show himself to the great world in the garment that he had literally trembled lest the father at the last minute might think to forbid it. It is quite possible that he would in this case have lied to the old man, saying that the sacred embroidery lay in the chest, whereas in reality it was packed among his luggage. The milk-white Huldah was a charming beast, a 3-year-old, wise and sweet-tempered, if also inclined to the harmless and engaging tricks which will sometimes betray the individuality of the dumb brute. She had eloquent velvet ears, and a droll fuzzy forelock hanging down to the great soft playful eyes, the corners of which were too prone to gather flies. From Huldah's back, various supplies and requisites for the journey were hung on both sides, the goatskin full of sour, thin milk to slake the thirst, and many-colored baskets and earthen pots with oatmeal and fruitcakes, parched corn, salt, olives, cucumbers, roast onions, and fresh cheeses. All this and more, designed for the refreshment of the traveler himself and for presents to his brothers, the father carefully inspected. Only one thing he failed to examine, an object which since time immemorial had formed the most indispensable luggage on a journey. A circular piece of leather, sewn round the edge with metal rings, which served the traveler as tablecloth and as table, too. It was a Bedouin invention, particularly in use by desert folk. They ran a string through the rings and hung it up as a bag for the journey. Joseph had done this, too, and with thievish joy he had thrust the ketonet into this leather bag. Since he had inherited it, he reasoned, since it was his own, why not show himself in it on his travels? The neighborhood folk on the road and field recognized him and joyfully called him by name, but after some hours' travel no one would know him. It would be well to show them, and not alone by the wealth of his provisioning, that a fine gentleman was riding by. And thus, the more so that the sun was rising too, he soon drew out the splendid garment and put it on in his own way to protect his head, so that the myrtle garland which he wore rested not upon his hair, but upon the veil that framed his face. On this first day he did not reach the shrine, to honor which had been another reason for wearing the ketonet. Jacob had admonished him with tears, also his own desire urged him, to stop there for sacrifice and prayer. It was only a furlong from Bethlama, where he spent the night with a man of Jacob's acquaintance, a carpenter who believed in God. Early on the second morning, after parting from his host, his wife, and their friends, he reached the spot. Huldah waited under the crutched mulberry tree, while Joseph, arrayed in the bridal finery, performed his prayers and poured his libations at the stone which had been erected by the way, the memorial for God, who, seeing it, might be reminded of what he had once done at this place. The stillness of the morning lay upon the vineyards and the rocky plots of ground. There was as yet no movement upon the Jerusalem road. A little wind played carelessly in the shining foliage of the tree. The landscape was still, and silently the shrine where Jacob once had laid the child of Laban to rest received the oblations and prayers of her son. He put water by the stone and raisin bread, kissed the ground beneath which a life so ready and willing had gone down, and stood up again to murmur formulas of veneration with lifted hands and the eyes and lips which he had from the departed. Nothing answered from the depths. The past kept silence, folded in forgetfulness, unable to feel. Such of it as had survived and was here present was himself, who wore her bridal gown and turned her very eyes toward heaven. Why could the maternal spirit, residing still in his own flesh and blood, not have warned him against his fate? Alas, it could not speak, being held in bonds by childish folly and self-indulgence. Joseph went on his way in great good cheer, upon made roads and along mountain paths. It was the smoothest journey in the world, its pleasantness unmarred by any mishap or unforeseen incident. Not that the earth exactly sprang to meet him, rather it spread itself charmingly before his eyes, and bade him welcome through the eyes and mouths of people whithersoever he came. He was strange to all, but his type is extraordinarily popular in these regions, and not alone by virtue of the veil did his appearance meet with favor and applause from all who saw him, especially the women. They sat suckling their babes by the garish sunlit village walls made of loose baked loam and dung, and the comfort afforded them by the suckling was heightened by the sight of the charming and well-favored youth who rode past. "Health to thee, thou sight for sore eyne," they called to him. "Blessed be she who bore thee, heart's darling." "And to you, all health," responded Joseph, flashing his teeth. "May your sons have dominion over many." "Thousand thanks," they called after him. "May Ashtar favor thee. Thou art like to one of her gazelles." For they all swore by Asherah, and thought of naught but her service. Many, again thanks to the veil, but also on the ground of his lavish provisioning, actually took him for a god, and were inclined to worship him. Still, this was only in the countryside, not in the walled towns, such as Beth Shemesh, Kirjath Ajan, Kirim Baalat, or the like, by whose ponds and city gates he chatted with the people, a crowd of whom often gathered round him. He astonished and delighted them by his urban culture, speaking of the magic numbers of God, of the wonders of the pendulum, and of the peoples of the globe. He told them, too, in order to flatter them, of the harlot of Uruk, who civilized the man of the forest. And in all that he said, he displayed such a charming sense of form and language that they thought amongst themselves he might well be the mazkir of a city prince and a great king's admonisher. He dazzled them by the knowledge of tongues which he had gleaned with old Eliezer's help, speaking Hittite at the city gate with a man from Hatti, Mitanian with one from the north, and a few words of Egyptian with a cattle dealer from the delta. It was not much that he knew, but a clever man speaks better with 10 words than a fool with 100, and he knew how to create, if not in his interlocutor, at least in the crowd, the impression of wonderful polyglot facility. For a woman who had had a horrible dream, he interpreted her dream for her at the fountain. She dreamed that her little son, a 3-year-old boy, had suddenly grown larger than herself and wore a beard. That meant, he told her, rolling the whites of his eyes into view, that her son would soon leave her, and she would indeed see him again, but only after many years, as a grown man with a beard. As the woman was very poor, and would quite possibly be forced to sell her son into slavery, the interpretation had a certain probability in itself, and all the folk marveled at so much beauty and wisdom embodied in the young traveler. He always had many invitations, and might have been a guest for days at a time. But he did not pause longer than human courtesy required, following, as well as might be, his father's directions for the journey. Of the 3 nights which separated his 4 days of travel, he spent the second in a house as the guest of a silversmith named Abasai, who had once visited Jacob, and who, while not exclusively adhering to the God of Abraham, yet paid him homage and excused the fact that he made idols of the moon metal by saying that, after all, he had to live. That Joseph granted him as a man of the world, and slept under his roof. The third of the brief spans of darkness he passed in the open, in a fig grove where he made his bed. For he had rested in the heat of the day, and thus reached his 3rd station so late that he hesitated to enter the town. The same thing happened the last night as he neared his goal, for he had slept again under trees in the daytime, overcome by the power of the sun, and taken the road again only toward evening. Thus the 2nd night watch had come on as he reached the narrow valley of Shechem, and from this moment on, in the measure that his journey had been easy and pleasant, by so much did it now seem altogether bewitched and bedeviled. He entered the valley, and by the light of the moon that swam, a slender bark in the skies, beheld the walled town with citadel and temple lying on the slope of Gerizim. And thereafter, nothing went right, but everything wrong and wry to the extreme. Joseph, indeed, was tempted to connect the change in his fortunes with the person of the man who met him in the night before Shechem, and made himself his companion for the last stage of his journey, leading up to the greatest change of all. The Man on the Field. We are told that he was wandering in the field. But what is the meaning of that? Had his father expected too much of him? And did young Joseph order his affairs so badly that he went astray and wandered lost? By no means. Wandering is not necessarily going astray, and if one seeks what is not there, he does not need to stray in order not to find it. Joseph had, as a boy, spent several years in the Vale of Shechem. The neighborhood was not strange to him. even though his familiarity with it had the quality of dreams, and likewise it was night, with an ineffectual moon. He did not stray, he sought, and since he did not find, his seeking became a straying in space. In the darkness and stillness, leading his beast by the bridle, he wandered about among rolling stretches of meadow and ploughland, above which the mountain brooded darkly in the starlight. And he thought, where may the brothers be? He came upon sheepfolds, of course, where the sheep slept standing, but whether these were Jacob's sheep was unknown, and there were no human creatures, the stillness being intense. Then he heard a voice, and perceived that he was addressed by a man whose approaching step he had not heard, but who nevertheless had overtaken him, and was now by his side. If he had come toward Joseph, the lad would have spoken. As it was, the stranger got in first, and said, Whom seekest thou? He did not ask, What seekest thou here? But simply, Whom seekest thou? And it may be that just this way of asking conditioned Joseph's rather childish and thoughtless answer. The lad was tired and confused, and his joy at meeting a human being in this accursed night walk was so great that he made the man, just because he was a man, the object of a simple and uncalled-for confidence. He said, I am seeking for my brethren. Tell me, dear man, I pray thee, where they graze. The dear man took no offense at the simplicity of this request. He seemed to be in a position to disregard it, and forbore to say to Joseph that his request was somewhat vague. He answered, They're not here, nor yet even in this neighborhood. Joseph looked at him in bewilderment as they went. He saw him quite clearly. This was not yet a man, in the full meaning of the word, being only a few years older than Joseph, but taller, really tall, wearing a sleeveless linen tunic drawn loosely through a girdle, thus freeing the knees, and a little mantle flung back over the shoulder. His head, resting upon a somewhat thick neck, seemed small by comparison. His brown hair made an oblique wave that partly covered the forehead down to the eyebrows. His nose was large, straight, and firmly modeled, the space between it and the small red mouth very narrow, but the depression beneath so soft yet so pronounced that the chin jutted out like a full round fruit. He turned his head rather affectedly on his shoulder and looked across it at Joseph. His eyes were not unlovely, but half-shut, with weary, half-dazed expression, as of one politely forbearing to yawn. His arms were round, but white and rather weak. He wore sandals and carried a stick which he had obviously cut for a staff. "Not here, then?" repeated the boy. "How can that be? They said so definitely that they were all going together to Shechem when they left home. Dost thou know them, then?" "A little," answered his companion. "As much as is needful. Oh, no, very familiar with them I am not. Indeed, no. Why dost thou seek them?" Because my father sent me to them, to greet them and to see whether things go well with them. Indeed, then thou art a messenger, even as I. I often make journeys on foot with my staff, but also I am a guide.
A guide?
Yes, truly. I guide travelers and open the ways for them. That is my business, and therefore I spoke to thee as I saw that thou wast seeking as thou wentest.
Thou seemest to know that my brethren are not here. But dost thou know where they are?
I think so.
Then tell me.
Art thou then so eager to see them?
Certainly I am eager for my goal, and that is my brethren, to whom my father hath sent me.
Well, then, I will name it to thee, thy goal. When I came by this place the last time on my ways, a few days ago, I heard thy brethren say, Up, we will go to Dothan, with a part of the sheep, for a change.
To Dothan?
Why not to Dothan? It occurred to them, and they did it. There is sweet pasturage in the valley of Dothan, and the people of the settlement on their hill are good for trade. They buy sinews, milk, and wool. Why art thou surprised?
Surprised I am not, for there is no matter for it. But it is an evil star. I was so certain I should find the brethren here.
Thou art not much used to having things go against thy will? Thou seemest a mother's boy to me.
I have no mother, replied Joseph in some annoyance. Nor I, said the stranger. Perhaps a father's boy?
No matter for that, responded Joseph. Rather advise me, what shall I do now?
Very simple. Thou goest to Dothan.
But it is night, and we are tired, Huldah and I. To Dothan, for so much I know already, is more than a furlong from here. With easy going, it is a day's journey.
Or a night's. Since thou sleepest under the trees by day, thou must take the night to reach thy goal.
How dost thou know that I slept under the trees?
Asking thy pardon, I saw. I came past on my staff where thou layest, and left thee behind. Then found I thee here.
I do not know the way to Dothan, especially at night, Joseph complained. The father hath not described it to me.
Rejoice, then, said the other, that I found thee. I am a guide, and will lead thee, if thou wilt. I will open to thee the road to Dothan without price, since I must go thither myself. I will take thee the shortest way, if thou wilt. We can take turns riding on thy ass.
A pretty beast, said he, and looked at Huldah with his half-open eyes, whose gaze expressed a negligence and contempt out of harmony with his words.
Pretty as thyself, but its pasterns are too weak.
Huldah, Joseph said, is next to Perash the best ass in Israel's stables. No one thinketh that her pastens are weak.
The stranger made a wry face.
Thou wouldst do better, he said, not to contradict me. It is foolish in more than one way. First, because thou art in my care, that thou mayest find thy brothers, and second, because I am older than thou. These two reasons will be clear to thee. When I say thy ass hath frail pasterns, then they are frail. There is no occasion for thee to defend them as though thou hadst made the ass, when thou canst only step before him and name him. And while we are talking about names, I should also like to beg thee not to call the good Jacob Israel in my hearing. It is unfitting and annoyeth me. Give him his proper name, and leave these high-flown titles alone.